If you break your arm, an x-ray gives you this very jagged white line. It's a clear, undeniable binary, right? Like the bone is broken or the bone is
Right,
fixed.
it's very straightforward to diagnose.
Exactly. But what happens when the injury isn't in your skeletal system, but it's buried deep within your default mode network?
That is where it gets incredibly complicated.
Yeah, and today on the Deep Dive, we are looking at a neuroscientific event that the medical world finally gave a formal name to just a few years ago. We've all experienced loss, or, we inevitably will. But today we're exploring this fascinating May 2026 article in the OOTW Journal.
Right, the one titled Psilocybin and Grief: The Neuroscience of Healing What Cannot Be Fixed.
That's the one. And the mission of this deep dive is to look at the cutting-edge neuroscience of why grief sometimes morphs into this inescapable neurological loop.
Yeah, and crucially, how the clinical application of psilocybin might trigger a profound physical system reset for a brain that is essentially frozen in time.
And for you listening, whether you track the evolving landscape of psychedelic psychiatry or you're just fascinated by the mechanics of human resilience, this exploration will completely dismantle how you view the brain's predictive powers.
It really shifts our entire framework.
It does, because to understand how the molecule fixes the loop, we have to look at the architecture of the loop itself, right? With prolonged grief disorder finally hitting the DSM-5-TR back in 2022, we now have a clinical boundary between standard mourning and this hyperspecific condition.
We do. And the data indicates PGD affects roughly 7 to 10% of bereaved individuals.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
It is. And it's characterized by this persistent disabling yearning that stretches beyond 12 months for adults, or I believe it's 6 months for children.
Right.
It brings severe identity disruption and profound emotional numbness. And I want to be clear, this isn't a psychological weakness or a failure of character. It is a measurable metabolic trap.
Okay, a metabolic trap.
Yeah, and to understand it, we really have to look at the default mode network.
The DMN. We usually talk about the DMN in the context of like daydreaming or self-reflection, but the article frames it as the brain's ultimate simulation engine.
Exactly. It runs predictive models of our environment, our future, and critically, the people we are attached to. Think about what the brain is fundamentally designed to do, which is to minimize surprise.
Right. Keep us safe by knowing what's coming.
Yes. It does this by constantly predicting what will happen next based on historical data. When you are deeply attached to someone, your DMN constructs a highly sophisticated, incredibly resource-heavy simulation of them.
So it's predicting the sound of their footsteps or their reactions to your jokes.
Their physical presence in the room, all of it. In a healthy grief response, the brain runs that simulation, encounters the painful reality of their absence, and then gradually updates its predictive model. The prior shift.
But in prolonged grief disorder, that update stalls out. There's a fantastic synthesis in the text drawn from Carhart-Harris and Friston's 2019 research that I
Oh,
love.
the prediction machine quote.
Yes. It says the brain is a prediction machine. Grief is the process of updating a model. Prolonged grief is what happens when the update stalls. So the DMN just becomes chronically hyperactive.
It does. Neuroimaging of individuals with PGD shows the DMN locked in a state of absolute overdrive. The brain generates the simulation of the deceased loved one,
Right.
crashes into the void of their absence, experiences the intense shock of that prediction error, and then, rather than updating the model, it simply restarts the simulation.
Okay, let's unpack this. So it's essentially like a smartphone's GPS aggressively recalculating a route to a destination that has been wiped off the map, just absolutely torching the battery in the process.
That's a really good starting point, but we can make it even more visceral. It's not just draining the battery, it's aggressively hoarding system resources from every other function.
Wow.
Yeah, the brain consumes about 20% of the body's resting metabolic energy. In PGD, a massive portion of that energy is being diverted just to sustain a ghost simulation.
So it's an exhausting cognitive predictive trap.
Exactly. And this is precisely why standard pharmacological interventions completely fail here.
Right, because if a patient presents with this level of functional impairment, a physician might instinctively reach for, like, an SSRI.
Sure, an antidepressant.
The article is quite explicit about this. PGD is a structural DMN problem, not a baseline serotonin deficit. Modulating serotonin tone doesn't rewrite a stalled predictive algorithm.
No, it doesn't. And furthermore, PGD completely deregulates the attachment circuitry. we see significant suppression of typical oxytocin expression in these patients.
Which means the person is not only cognitively trapped in a loop, they are neurochemically isolated.
Yes. The specific system designed to process social bonding and relational loss has effectively gone offline.
So they're stranded. Which brings us to the intervention rate. The neuroscientific field is investigating how psilocybin physically forces a system reset. And rather than just calling it magic, the article breaks down the mechanics, starting with the RBUS model.
Rebus. Relaxed beliefs under psychedelics. This gets to the very core of how the brain weights its predictions.
Okay, how so?
Well, psilocybin has a very high affinity for 5-HT2A receptors, which are heavily concentrated in cortical layer V neurons. And these specific neurons act as the top-down conductors of the brain's predictive coding.
They hold the blueprints, the priors.
Yes, the dominant predictive beliefs. In PGD, the simulation of the lost person is weighted so heavily that reality literally can't penetrate it.
It's locked in.
Exactly. But when psilocybin binds to those layer V receptors, it introduces acute entropy into the system. It dramatically reduces the precision weighting of those high-level priors.
So in plain terms, it temporarily flattens the rigid walls of the simulation.
That's a great way to put it, yes.
So the cognitive barriers are lowered. The brain stops aggressively insisting on its outdated model. But we just established that the patient is also dealing with severe neurochemical isolation due to oxytocin suppression.
Right, the attachment system being offline.
Yeah, an open mind doesn't mean much if the attachment system is still offline. How does the process bridge that gap?
This is where the subjective experience of the session becomes biologically critical. Roseman's 2019 research demonstrated that the mystical type experiences induced by psilocybin correlate with a massive surge in oxytocin release.
Oh, wow. So it forces the bonding system back online.
Exactly. Because grief is, at its core, a relational wound. By triggering that oxytocin surge while the cognitive defenses are flattened, the molecule temporarily reopens lockdown attachment circuitry.
So they can finally feel it.
Yes, it creates a neurobiological window where the patient can fully encounter the relational loss, process the magnitude of it, and actually move through the emotion rather than standing frozen at the perimeter.
Now, putting myself in the shoes of a listener who might be carrying profound grief, this combination of effects sounds incredibly daunting.
It does sound intimidating, yeah.
If you tell me a compound is going to flatten my beliefs and introduce entropy to my deepest attachments, I mean, am I just chemically detaching? Is the treatment going to erase the intensity of my love for that person?
It is a totally valid fear, but the neurobiology points to the exact opposite outcome. We have to look at the mechanism of memory reconsolidation. You are not erasing the data, you are changing how the data is stored.
Okay, so like pulling a highly sensitive file out of a secure cabinet, editing the document, and putting it back.
Close, but it's much more dynamic than just editing text. The emotional weight of that file actively discharges while it's out of the cabinet.
Hmm.
Whenever a memory is retrieved, it enters a transient labile state before it is re-encoded back into long-term storage.
Ah, I see.
In a psilocybin session, because the predictive rigidity is down and the oxytocin is flowing, the memory of the deceased can be fully accessed. The patient feels the absolute totality of the emotion.
But in a safe way.
Right. Because they are feeling it in a highly plastic-supported state, the memory is re-encoded with an updated emotional valence. The love remains entirely intact. But the agonizing, unresolved, yearning, the cognitive glitch completes its arc.
It's completion, not deletion. And the physical evidence for this is wild. The fMRI scans showing the DMN reset. We're talking about measurable, boldy signal changes showing acute disintegration of the network during the peak of the experience.
The rigid self-referential loops literally dissolve on the scan. But the magic isn't just in the disintegration, it's in the post-acute phase.
The aftermath.
Exactly. In the days and weeks following the session, the network reorganizes. The entropy subsides, and the DMN establishes much healthier, more flexible, functional connectivity patterns.
Okay, so the mechanistic theory is airtight. We have the Rebus S model flattening the priors, the oxytocin surge re-engaging the attachment system, memory reconsolidation discharging the emotional loop, and the DMN physically resetting.
It's a very elegant process.
It really is.
Yeah.
But we have to pivot from the elegance of the molecule to the messy reality of clinical trials. Where does the actual human data stand in 2026?
Well, we have to be critically honest here. There are currently no completed randomized controlled trials, specifically isolating psilocybin-assisted therapy for prolonged grief disorder.
Wait, really? None.
Not yet. The foundational data we are relying on is extrapolated from studies targeting existential distress.
Ah, mostly in oncology, like the landmark 2016 Hopkins study with patients facing life-threatening cancer diagnosis.
Yes, exactly. In that cohort, 80% of participants demonstrated clinically significant sustained reductions in depression and anxiety. But what is truly staggering is the follow-up data.
Right. Ajean Leaves and her team evaluated that exact same cohort 4.5 years later in 2020.
And the benefits held.
Which is fundamentally absurd when you compare it to the decay curve of traditional psychiatric drugs.
It is practically unheard of. If a patient stops taking an SSRI, the modulatory effects typically decay within weeks or, you know, maybe months. The fact that a single macro dose session yielded a half decade of psychological durability strongly suggests that the underlying predictive model of the brain was permanently updated.
So the trauma wasn't being suppressed daily by a chemical of Thero. The architecture of the mind had changed.
Precise.
Which brings up a massive point of friction in how this science is entering the mainstream. While reading the ODTW Journal source text, I noticed a banner ad right in the middle of the article. It was selling OTW mushroom chocolate.
Oh, yes. So that.
Claiming it was precision dosed for daily ritual and cognitive performance. And I think it highlights this dangerous public misconception. You cannot cure clinical prolonged grief disorder by eating premium cacao on your couch on a random Tuesday, can you?
No. It's the perfect illustration of late-stage capitalism entirely missing the clinical point.
Mm.
A psychedelic molecule on its own is just a tool. It is a scalpel. And a scalpel without a trained surgeon is just a hazard.
The neuroplasticity window opens, but there's no architecture to guide the reorganization.
Precisely. This is why the clinical protocols established by MAPS and Johns Hopkins emphasize the therapeutic container above all else.
The container. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. This involves weeks of intention setting with specialized therapists before the drug is ever administered. During the dosing session, therapists often use symbolic, relational objects to help the patient deliberately encounter the lost person. And crucially, there is extensive integration therapy afterward.
Right. The article notes how seamlessly this maps onto established modalities, like Dr. Shear's complicated grief treatment, which focuses heavily on meaning reconstruction.
Exactly.
Because you need the container. When the DMN disintegrates, the brain is hypervulnerable. If you just take the chocolate bar in isolation, the network might reorganize right back into the exact same rigid loop or worse, encode a new trauma.
The relational wound requires a relational container to heal. The molecule provides the plasticity, the therapy provides the direction.
That makes total sense. But looking at the clinical framework brings us to a significant blind spot in the current science. If we look at who is actually participating in these trials, the data pool is incredibly narrow.
It is deeply skewed. The literature relies overwhelmingly on highly resourced demographics, mostly white, affluent individuals who have the means to navigate clinical trial access alongside the specific cancer populations we discussed.
Meanwhile, the demographics with the highest statistical rates of prolonged grief disorder are almost entirely absent from the literature.
It's a huge problem.
We don't have robust data on parents mourning the loss of a child. We don't have data on communities shattered by sudden violence or individuals where profound grief overlaps with systemic complex trauma.
It is a gaping scientific void. If our entire understanding of this treatment is based on end-of-life existential anxiety, we cannot responsibly assume the mechanisms will map perfectly onto a mother who lost her child to gun violence.
You're right.
The threat simulations running in her DMN are fundamentally different from those of an oncology patient.
And beyond the demographic skew, the article touches on a fascinating cultural friction. The Western psychiatric model is built on pathology, right? It frames prolonged grief as a disorder, an aberration that needs to be treated, processed, and ultimately filed away so the individual can return to baseline productivity.
Whereas many indigenous and non-Western frameworks do not view grief as a problem to be solved, they utilize what psychologists term a continuing bonds model.
Continuing bonds.
Yeah. In these cultures, the psychological goal is not to finalize a detachment from the deceased. The goal is to cultivate an ongoing dynamic relationship with the ancestors.
So what does this all mean for the future of global therapy? If global therapy starts exporting the psilocybin protocol, where the Western metric of a successful outcome means the patient no longer actively dialogues with the deceased, aren't we risking an incredibly arrogant form of harm?
We absolutely are.
If a patient's culture demands they maintain spiritual communication with their ancestors for community health, our clinical model is essentially pathologizing their cultural baseline.
It's a profound clinical tension. If the medicine strips away the rigid priors, what dictates the shape of the new priors? The neuroplasticity triggered by the 5-HT2A receptors is a universal human biological mechanism. But the destination of the psychological update, what a healthy, reorganized brain looks like, is culturally subjective.
Wow.
Any future protocol must let the patient's cultural framework hold the map rather than imposing a Western standard of closure.
It fundamentally changes how we have to look at the end game of therapy. Let's pull all these threads together. We started by examining how the default mode network and about 7 to 10% of mourners get snagged in this exhausting, metabolically draining, predictive loop.
Right.
We unpacked how psilocybin disrupts this by flattening the brain's rigid priors through layer V neurons while simultaneously triggering an oxytocin surge that brings the attachment circuitry back online.
We also explored how this temporary window of neuroplasticity allows for profound memory reconsolidation, letting the emotional weight of the loss discharge without erasing the love.
And we looked at the astonishing 4.5-year durability of these structural changes, provided they happen within a highly specialized therapeutic container, not just from a commercial chocolate bar.
Exactly.
To you listening, internalizing these mechanisms is a brilliant shortcut to understanding the broader human condition. It's not just about the clinical mechanics of psychedelics. It's about realizing how stubbornly, and sometimes destructively, our brains will cling to outdated realities just to shield us from the shock of the present.
They're just trying to protect us.
Exactly. The brain isn't broken. It's just executing a protection algorithm that desperately needs an update.
Which leads to a final staggering thought to leave you with based on where this science is heading. We've established today that psychedelics can render profound, identity-defining memories malleable enough to be re-encoded without their agonizing emotional charge.
Right.
If this mechanism of updating the predictive model can safely resolve the deep relational wound of losing someone in a single lifetime, well, what happens when we apply this to generational trauma?
Oh, wow. Wait, really?
Think about it. What if the locked priors and hyperactive threat simulations running in someone's DMN aren't solely the result of their own lived experience, but are inherited predictive models passed down through a lineage marked by historical violence or displacement?
That is, wow.
If a clinical DMN reset can rewire one person's map of reality, could it eventually be the key to updating the inherited survival architecture of an entire family tree?
That is an unbelievable concept to sit with. The idea that by accessing the state of neuroplasticity, we might not just be healing the individual, but actively rewriting the predictive code for the next generation. Thank you for taking this journey with us today.
It was a pleasure.
The next time you feel your own mind looping endlessly on a painful memory, remember, your brain is a prediction machine doing its absolute best to keep you safe. Sometimes the bravest thing you can do is give it permission to finally update the model. See you on the next deep dive.